Tonight we welcome the testimony of the Honorable Janet Yellen.
The economy appears to have grown at a moderate pace on average so far this year.
Is what you're doing now essentially gently applying the brakes?
We've had our foot on the gas. We've been in an accommodative stance, and as we've come closer to achieving our objectives, we've taken our foot off the gas to some extent so that we can sustain a strong recovery.
Yeah, probably a C-minus and probably deserved worse in economics.
You're not necessarily bearish on the future of jobs and work.
So I don't have a crystal ball, and these are very difficult.
But you're very smart, and you look at a lot of data, so.
Is tax reform one of those things that could be really helpful?
I would certainly agree that appropriately designed tax reform could have a favorable effect on productivity.
I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. We did that last time.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it was another good week for the market this week. Stock market at record territory. Janet Yellen testifying on Capitol Hill saying, well, still more one rate increase for this year, and they could begin shrinking their balance sheet as soon as September. Markets seem to like it as we are in positive territory. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in Hour 1 will be Dave Nikoski from Vermilion Research. He's talking about Dow Transports confirming the Dow Theory buy signal. But he said basically Dow Theory less relevant. Transports are no longer just railroads. And, well, the Dow Industrials are no longer just industrial stocks. We'll talk about the influence of indexing on the markets. And we'll talk about why this may just be a correction. Dave sees this as a period very similar going back to 1994 and 2000. Also later on in the program, John Ng will be joining me from Maison Placement, and we'll be talking about things that could be a catalyst for gold buying going forward. One of them could be central bank buying, which is occurring, and also the possibility about peak gold and why there will be less gold production going forward. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. When the leaders of the world's largest hedge funds speak, people tend to listen. And Ray Dalio was talking recently about the fact that, the dance is still going on, but perhaps you may want to keep an eye on the exit door and just sort of slide over there, because given what the Fed is currently doing, it seems like the era of loose liquidity and easy money is coming to an end, and that will mean radical changes in the various markets. We'll talk about that and Janet Yellen's testimony on Capitol Hill this week and how it all ties together. And also, you know, technology is the driving force behind the U.S. economy, beginning with the tech revolution of the 80s and 90s. Where is it going in the future, and what impact will that happen on investments? Because the way we're living, investing, buying, spending, and doing everything else is all changing rapidly. Literally, there's a new revolution every 7 to 10 years now. It's accelerating at a breathtaking pace. We'll discuss all of that today on The Big Picture as part of the Financial Sense News Hour. But first, we would like to hear from Ryan Poplava, which is customary here on the program. Fresh eyes, Ryan, for the major stock indices this week, with a very strong finishing close on Friday. The New York Stock Exchange Composite, the S&P 500, the Dow Jones Industrial, and the Dow Jones Transport Averages all hit record highs on Friday, with the Russell 2K Small Cap Index and the NASDAQ Composite within spitting distance of their respective highs. It seems like the old adage, sell in May, it no work good this summer.
Something is terribly wrong.
What is driving the buying interest this week towards all of these new highs anyway?
Well, John, the key events this week were Janet Yellen's congressional testimony, and then also the beginning of the second quarter earnings season started. That kicked off on Friday with three major banks quoting their earnings were better than expected. And they did, I believe, talk about increasing loan growth. But I think, you know, a lot of these banks had a great run-up already this month. And given that the results weren't just blockbuster, we did see the banks sell off on Friday. But that didn't take the market with it. The rest of the market, as you said, yeah, it hit new highs. And then there was the economic data that came out this week. There was some positives, some negatives. On the negative side, it was the CPI, which was unchanged and showing actually a drop in year over year. And we could talk about that later. But also the retail sales was a miss, down about, I think, 0.2%. But the message sent from Janet and the weak CPI and retail economic figures announced this week have kind of communicated that it may be time to see a pause in the Fed's glide path towards higher Fed funds, at least until maybe December, which is what I'm hearing a lot of people model right now. And I did do a check. I looked at the December Fed futures contracts, which people put their money towards these contracts. They actually have a pretty high correlation with fairly decent predictive power right now, showing a 50% chance, or actually a less than 50% chance, we'll get another rate increase until December. Anything leading up until that, the percentages were really low. And that produced the same lift in sentiment we've seen in stocks over the past couple of years concerning this whole idea with a very accommodative Fed revolving around low growth and these, I guess you can call them dovish hikes, in that they're not really putting the screws to rates, really tightening quickly, trying to close off credit. They're not doing that. A very slow and steady process, allowing the market to have this kind of Goldilocks mentality right now.
Okay, what was the comment that the press and investors highlighted this week that communicated Fed Chair Janet Yellen's leaning on the dovish side regarding their policy stance now?
Well, in her statement, it actually came out before her testimony, before she was appearing before Congress and being asked questions specifically about the economy and a lot of political questions in there as well regarding fiscal policy. But her comments basically stated that she sees roughly equal odds the U.S. economy's performance will be somewhat stronger or somewhat less strong. So not quite saying, you know, negative, you know, decelerating, but said less strong than the Fed currently projects. And by shifting her viewpoint towards this kind of more balanced approach towards growth, essentially lifted those areas that typically do well when the Fed speaks more dovishly. In a time of maximum liquidity and low growth, the winners have been, since 2009, specifically U.S. stocks, developed economy stocks, and then going inside technology stocks, growth stocks, high yield bonds, emerging market bonds, based on performance, like I said, since 2009. So those areas, that's what really lifted on Friday. Some of those big, large name tech stocks that have led the market so far this year came roaring back this week. And the losers have been what have been typically losers in this reflationary type of environment, which oddly enough is oil, cash, treasuries, resources, and value stocks. So high dividend payers have not performed all that well. What do you think is the leadership this year?
I believe, at least I think the candidate there is equities, but is that changing at all? I mean, you've been talking about oil inventories going down, but you've also said that OPEC is cheating and the exemption for Libya and Nigeria has actually eclipsed their cutting efforts. I mean, oil, it seems, has bottomed a short term based on inventory data. But what about the dollar's decline? I mean, why weren't we seeing gold and oil lift up from here?
John, those are really great questions. And you and I, we've been touching a little bit about commodities more so recently because there have been some catalysts. Mind you, I think Russia is having a meeting at the end of this month. A lot of OPEC members will be there, maybe looking to do some more, maybe a little bit of a surprise meeting given, you know, what oil has done. It's been still languishing here in the $40 range for West Texas Intermediate. But, you know, I believe these areas, from the commodity standpoint, are bottoming from a secular level, but that does take time. We've been in these very narrow trading ranges, which has been good because, you know, the dollar had such a great move since 2014. And, you know, I will say that one of the biggest reasons we have not encouraged any investment in these areas ourselves over the past few years has been really related to a divergence in central bank policies and its effect on the U.S. dollar. That's the fundamental catalyst. Mind you, back when we were telling all of our investors, our listeners, to get into precious metals, that was when the U.S. dollar was falling, and it was falling by a number of fundamental catalysts at the time from the early 2000s. But put simply, right now, the Fed has been tightening policy and the ECB has been loosening policy since 2014, which led to this huge divergence between the two, leading to a rise in the dollar index, a rise in Europeans investing more here, driving up the demand for dollars. So, you know, just thinking from their perspective, why would you invest if you're over in Europe in negative or low yields when you could put that in the US? You know, I think Draghi's comments recently, June 27th, we talked about it quite a few weeks ago. He said that low inflation is basically transitory. And while he didn't really intend it to be this really huge market message, the market took it as a very big message that quite possibly this could be the precursor and turning point in the ECB now beginning to taper its accommodation, to begin to remove its accommodation. Because as you know, we talked about just last week, I think the EU's Purchasing Managers Index data was reaching up near 58. Anything above 50 is expansionary, and that's the highest at 58. It's been in several years. So they're starting to come to this conclusion that, yeah, we're finally out of the European sovereign debt crisis. We're finally out of the economic recession that they've been in. Banks are becoming more capitalized. Deutsche Bank, beyond that one. So is this a turning point from the two central banks and the divergence in the two policies? Now, is it possible that these two are now going to be getting closer together? And I think eventually the ECB will need to officially begin discussing that taper process of its QE. We know that as their economy continues to expand like Bernanke did. And the markets took his comments to suggest the ECB is doing just that. So, you know, we'll see. They are going to meet next week.
Okay, so here's a question on all that. If then the policy reverses and that gap between monetary policy narrows by the ECB easing off the gas and the Federal Reserve easing off the brakes for a short while, then that could cause the dollar to reverse that policy trade. And therefore, as I see it, we could see possibly a reflationary trade all by itself without even talking about wage inflation, right?
Exactly. The dollar, there was a huge correlation just between the dollar and commodities. So if the dollar is weakening, it's supposed to be reflationary with commodity prices going up, oil going up. Jim has talked about it for decades of the influence of energy on inflationary pressures. So, you know, if commodity prices go up and rates are going up, it all feeds on itself. It will eventually do one thing and provide a widening profit spread in the curve, the yield curve, for banks. Banks borrowing on the short end from the Fed and then loaning out to businesses and other institutions. But eventually, here's where things go down the line. Eventually, as rates go up long term, it begins to cut off the profitability of investments, the profitability of projects, and it leads towards a cyclical downturn. And that's why we constantly are talking about the Fed. Its policy, is it tightening? Is it normalizing? If it's tightening, there's a high correlation between how long the Fed tightens and when eventually a recession occurs. And you know, just talking about the dollar and its influence, if this gap narrows, then yes, the dollar is going to continue to weaken. And we've seen that. You know, the dollar fell big time when Draghi made his comments on the 27th and currently continues to sit at fresh year-to-date lows. In fact, a new low on this Friday. And that's because we got CPI data that was unchanged year over year, was down from 1.9% in May down to 1.6% last month in June. And that's leading the markets further to assume that, hey, we're not going to see any more rates from the Fed, at least for a while, at least maybe until the end of this year, December, maybe early next year. At the same time, John here, the Fed is trying to gear the markets up to a balance sheet adjustment process. So maybe it's trying to say, hey, let's cool down a little bit here on the rates. Obviously, you know, look at the yield curve, fairly flat. Let's start looking at policies and things that we can do on the long end. And at the same time, like I said, if we see Draghi, the ECB, beginning to ease off on the gas, like you said, this gap narrowing between the two, it's going to have reverberating effects on the currencies, reverberating effects on the commodities.
But if the catalyst for the Fed is low inflation and low growth, like we saw this week in the CPI and retail sales figures down 0.2%, then here's the question. Why would the Fed shift to another policy tool and tighten there instead of just pause altogether? It doesn't make sense.
In my opinion, the biggest catalyst towards the Fed refocusing its policy tool focus here from rates to the balance sheet, I think the biggest catalyst is the yield curve itself. And I've talked about this, I think, years ago when we talked about tapering and we talked about raising interest rates. You know, since the Fed began raising interest rates again, it did so a couple years ago, paused almost full year of 2016, and then did it again in December of 2016. You look at what has happened in that spread between the 10-year treasury and the 2-year treasury. That spread has fallen from 130 basis points in December to near 80 currently right now. So that spread is very narrow. The curve, very flat. And the Fed can't keep addressing just the short end of the curve without finally addressing the long end in the balance sheet. So, yeah, I think they've talked about it. A lot of the officials have inferred it months ago. They came out with the minutes recently, and everything is pointing towards this is now in the policy discussion last time. They're talking about, hey, we actually have a plan. Here's what it looks like. You know, it's that $10 billion they're going to allow to roll off initially, and that's going to ramp up. They will shift this focus, hold rates maybe for the next 5 months, and soon begin to allow bonds to roll off their balance sheet, decreasing demand for those long-term bonds, therefore decreasing demand on purchases, which causes the price to drop, driving yields and rates higher. This will be kind of like, I don't know, do you remember Operational Twist? They sold short-term bonds and bought long-term bonds to drive interest rates down, tried making it a very neutral type of policy, net-net, and just trying to change the yield curve. I think they're doing it again, just in reverse right now. It is our feeling that a policy tightening, going back to your question here, a policy tightening is a policy tightening, no matter what tool you use. So if they do this, sort of a reverse twist, if you want to call it, it will still be another step towards normalization, which is their goal, right? That's their long-term goal. And this is just doing it a different way. It's finally addressing, I think, the yield curve, which has been badly needed and is badly going to be needed to help out the financial banks.
Well, as I always say on the show, it should be interesting. You know, it's interesting times to cover this type of stuff. It is not dull by any means, and it will be interesting to see what the ECB says next week, whether they admit to finally discussing a taper of their bond purchasing facility or not. So we'll have something to talk about next week, obviously. We look forward to hearing your analysis and wrap-up report for the financial markets next week. It's always fun, Ryan.
You got it, John. We'll talk to you next week.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Russia's not expecting big concessions out of the United States. They can see all of these challenges surrounding the White House, and really, Russia benefits from the chaos. They'd like to see Washington hugely disrupted by this crisis, and they can continue to stoke that fire. And, you know, in the meantime, it's interesting to see how Russia positions itself in multiple theaters across the globe, trying to make sure that it's ready for when it can draw the U.S. into a negotiation.
Well, it's become routine. Just about every single week we talk on this show, the market is in record territory. And it's doing it once again. Joining us on the program from Vermilion Research is Dave Nikoski. Dave, let's talk about something, one of the oldest technical theories, Dow theory. The industrials were making new highs, but the transports were having difficulty. Now we have seen the transports confirm the industrials as they break into new territory. Let's talk about the significance of that and what that means.
Well, I think for the technician, you know, it's always a good sign that we get some confirmation from an index to, you know, support a breakout within the industrials. You know, I think one thing that we lose sight of, however, is that, you know, throughout time, we've changed the makeup in the context of what the Dow industrials are, and we started adding tech names to them just a few years ago. And when you add the likes of something like an Apple after it's had a huge run, I think in any ordinary circumstance, we probably wouldn't look at Apple as a industrial company. And I think we have to take that in context with how the theory was developed quite a few years ago, well before my time. But the makeup of the indices, I think, has changed so dramatically. And even when we look at something like the S&P 500, and there's much discussion about how we've taken out the 2000 highs, most people don't realize that almost 50% of that index has changed since 2000. So we really have, you know, the emergence of new leadership. And historically, when we look back at things like the Nifty 50 period of the early 70s, one can look back and see what leadership looked like at that time. And believe it or not, it was the names like Xerox and Kodak and Polaroid. And no one talks about those particular stocks anymore. And I think that you're seeing that much the same with what led in 2000 versus what's leading today.
You know, you bring up a rather significant point, because when the theory was developed well over 100 years ago, when we talked about industrials, you thought about car companies, you thought about General Electric. When you thought about transports, you thought about railroads. Today, the transports are railroads, you know, planes, trains, automobiles, just about everything. And the industrials in this modern technological society we have, as you just mentioned, Apple. More of our companies are tech companies that make up part of the Dow, which is also part of the U.S. economy.
Absolutely. And the part that I'm trying to add to that is the significance of how, if you want to call it, you know, market evolution is taking place. And I think it just provides a perspective of how the mind shift has changed over the decades. And, you know, the longer we get out from the original theory, I think we'll be talking about a new theory that will have developed over the next several years. Again, I think it's important to keep everything in context. And, you know, much like what you've alluded to, the transports are certainly affirming what the Dow is doing. You know, the rails are doing quite fine. Airlines are doing quite fine. And that, of course, is on the back of what has been a declining crude oil price. I think that's significant. You're seeing some of the truckers on the large cap side showing, you know, some fantastic technical patterns that would be indicative of, I think, a very good and healthy economy.
I want to talk about something else. You mentioned how the indexes have changed dramatically, especially like the S&P, where a significant portion of that index changes. Dave, I want to talk about the influence of indexing today. I read somewhere that almost $800 billion of new money will be going, or money from someplace else will be going into index funds, and how that shapes the indexes that we follow on a day-to-day basis. For example, we know if money goes into the Qs or a NASDAQ index fund, almost 11 or 12% of it is going to go into Amazon. So I wonder if you might address this idea about the FANG stocks and how much of that is influenced by what we're seeing going on with indexing.
Yeah, I think when we look back at history and see other periods such as this, I think probably the most significant one was, you know, the call. And I don't want to come out and mention names here, but back in the 90s, there was a very famous fund manager that came out and said, "Hey, you can't beat the index." And this was right around the period of 1994, 95. He said, "You can't beat the index, you might as well own it." You know, I think one of the things that concerns me as a technician, and most fund managers would recognize this, is when you do start to get into a bubble where you get into the indexing, obviously more funds are thrown at the things that are working and more money comes out of the things that are not working. And I think with the advent of the ETFs over the last several years and, you know, moving into kind of a passive investing aspect, I think that can spell trouble, and it depends on how narrow leadership goes. Right now, we don't have leadership extremely narrow when it comes to sector orientation. One of the things that we've done over our time period is within our database, for instance, we have all the historical information on every stock that's ever traded since 1969 to present. That includes bought out, bankrupt, you know, things like Standard Oil, Eastern Airlines. And to give you a kind of a perspective, and I think that's what we try to do here at Vermilion, is provide that perspective of looking for anomalies within, you know, the market. And I think one thing that stands out to me is when you look at the divergence between the best sector and the worst sector on an average for any given year since 1969, it's roughly about 47% deviation. So when we're looking at the overall market and we're seeing money come into, for instance, an S&P index fund, I think one of the things that would concern me, again, is if we saw a measurable outperformance by large caps versus small caps and mid caps. Right now, we're not seeing that. But I do think that when we get out towards the so-called, quote, top, unquote, you're going to see that more and more funds are going to go into a sub-industry of a sector much more than anything else. And you're going to see that the divergence between the best and worst sectors are going to grow, and they're going to grow significantly. So I think that, again, the indexing aspect is going to set its own problems at some point in the future, and just how do we analyze that and how do we get to that? And I think the best time period that we would look at, for instance, would be that, you know, 95 period to 2000, where you had significant divergences in best to the worst sectors. And I think that certainly holds true when you look at other areas and other bubbles, such as the oil bubble back in 1980 to 83, and the deflation or the disinflation that took place after the oil bubble cracked.
You know, it does remind me, because I can remember, gosh, I think it was 1999, where the NASDAQ was up almost 70%. If you wanted to make money in 1999, you had to be all on technology. And let's, speaking of technology, move on to the technology sector, which has been one of the strong market leaders. It's pulled back lately with some of the FANG stocks. What's your take on the technology sector here? Is it still in a leadership role with a small correction here as it heads higher? Do you see that going forward?
Yeah, I see this only as a correction, and I think I would put this in that 94 to 2000 category when it comes to, you know, performance. And again, I don't think that we're in a bubble. I do believe that it's going to continue to outperform and outperform significantly. I think what we're seeing right now is kind of a timeout in some of the FANG stocks, and they're just going to be consolidating at this level. I think there's a lot of concern that if the FANGs roll over, that this market could certainly roll over with it. From a market cap perspective, that's certainly true. I recall a period in 2012 that was also suggested by the likes of Apple and just how big it was at that point in time. I know our group, we stayed positive on the market only because we didn't see enough charts breaking down from a technical perspective in terms of relative strength and patterns. And what you actually saw is even with Apple pulling back, the S&P did a small pullback in reverse course and went absolutely vertical. And what you saw is you saw some of the money come out of Apple and realize, hey, the rest of the market might be somewhat cheap relative to the PE and the growth expectations for Apple. So I still think that that's a possibility, that we can have the pullback in the FANG stocks enough to get investors alarmed to pull some money out and move it into other areas of the market that certainly have been less stellar per se, but the technical patterns in the majority of the market, in my view, is extremely constructive.
Let's talk about the area of the markets that have not been doing well. You're seeing a downturn in utilities, consumer staples, materials, and energy. What does that tell you?
The question is do we have the reflation trade still going on? I would posit that yes, we do, and I think that the supply of things such as in the materials and within the confines of energy are suggestive that we can bring up to speed a significant amount of supply in a very short period of time now, whereas you couldn't do that in the past. We relied on offshore drilling, which from the time that you drop the drill bit in to the time you get the end product, it took years. Today, we can do that in a very short period of time. I think that's constructive. I think that what we see right now on the global front within, you know, the reflation trade is you're seeing China is certainly showing some significance in terms of their chart patterns. India looks fantastic. Europe has come out of its doldrums over the last several years. You know, looking at the financials in Europe, you're getting close to breaking about a 7 to 8 year relative strength downtrend in the financials in Europe in terms of their banks. And I think that's a positive sign if we do break that downtrend. We've been bullish on Europe, you know, since last fall, seeing much more constructive patterns coming out of there. And again, I think that when we look at the U.S. versus the rest of the world, there's just right now there's better opportunity and outside the U.S. But again, I think that we're going to see the recoupling of the U.S. and the rest of the world because we did decouple over the last several years from the rest of the world. Now the rest of the world is starting to show some signs of playing catch up. And I think that's going to be great going forward.
You know, you bring up an interesting question, because with oil pulling back, gold pulling back, when you look at commodities, about the only thing that's really going through the roof because of drought has been the agricultural commodities like wheat. And typically, Dave, as you know, in the fourth quarter, we typically get the reflation trade, and some are questioning whether that's still possible. So it seems like to me, let's talk about oil. Oil's a key factor there.
I do think that energy is in the process of bottoming. And when we look at other time periods where we see a washout in a commodity such as oil, and I think the more recent one would have been obviously January of last year. However, the prior one of that was in the fall of 1998. We were hitting, you know, $10, $11 a barrel, and you saw on the covers of every financial magazine that, you know, oil was going to be $10 to $11 a barrel for the next decade. Well, that lasted up until early 2001. I should say late 2001, early 2002, when you saw, from a technical perspective, you saw a lot of the energy charts breaking 25-year plus price and relative strength downtrends, which suggested leadership for that next decade. And I think that low prices usher in larger consumption, and it's going to help the rest of the world grow, and especially when you look at, you know, areas such as India and China, where some of the greatest expense from a consumer standpoint, it continues to be energy and food. And when those barriers come down, I think it's going to usher in a larger amount of consumption, and it's going to move the lower class up into the middle class within those countries. So, again, I see that this is kind of a temporary. I don't see it as long-term leadership yet, but at some point, again, the pendulum will swing far and wide and much longer. And again, the thing that always heals low prices is low prices. And that's what I would look forward to in the next several years.
All right, let's move on to another area. Janet Yellen is on Capitol Hill this week saying that, you know, she sees a gradual increase in interest rates. The market is pricing in another rate increase, most likely in December. She emphasized that they will start shrinking their balance sheet, which is another form of tightening. There seems to be unanimity in that, and that could begin as soon as, let's say, the third quarter. At the beginning of the year, there were predictions that we would be hitting 3% on the 10-year Treasury note. Here on the day you and I are speaking, that's a little above 2.3%. Rates have come down or remain rather low despite two rate hikes this year and one coming in December. What's your take on interest rates here?
There's three directions to interest rates, and I think we all forget that. You know, several years ago, majority of the market was looking for higher rates, and we just kept dropping. And the directions are really up, down, and sideways. And right now, I would say that we're in the confines of a sideways movement within interest rates. And, you know, until we get above, I would say it's right around the 3%, 3.2%, do we actually see a true reversal in the long-term interest rates. But until then, it's going to be, you know, much shorter moves, but they're still going to be very quick. They're going to be painful in the short term. But again, this is a, you know, the process of making lows in rates is truly a process, and that process is going to take time. And whether it's 1 year, 5 years, or 10 years, I don't think anyone's going to agree on it. You can put four people on your show, and they're all going to come up with a different answer. Until they break out, and, you know, 2.6 on a shorter term basis would be suggestive of ushering in a 2.6 to 3.2 trading range. Anything dropping below the 200-day moving average or below 2.1% certainly puts you into possibly moving up to the 1.9%. So again, we can make all kinds of predictions that we want. I don't think the market really knows where we should be, and that's why you're seeing rates move like they have been.
So outside of that, given where we are right now, seems like, as you mentioned, some of these FANG stocks have pulled back. Technology is maybe correcting a little bit here. You expect it to resume leadership. If you had to put money in the market right now, where's the best place to put it? Because we've seen, in addition to our stocks breaking out to record levels, we also have the international markets doing as well.
Absolutely. I think there's a number of places that, for us as technicians, look extremely attractive. Healthcare certainly is probably the most recent reversal in terms of relative strength downtrends. Biotech, so you have the IBB breaking above 300 with some significant force. It would suggest that biotechs look attractive. You had mentioned, you know, some of the agri-fertilizer stocks or the agricultural stocks. You know, even the fertilizer stocks look like they may be forming a bottom, and it's still early there, so I haven't given the green light on it. But I think it's certainly a possibility. Some of the rail component suppliers. You got like a Wabco, looks absolutely terrific. Looking through their charts within that group, looks fantastic. Industrials, still like all the aerospace stocks, a majority of them continue to benefit, which looking down again at the prospect of lower energy rates, I think you're going to continue to do well within the aerospace stocks and the aero defense. Financials look absolutely terrific, huge bases on them, all suggest that we're going to see them move much higher over the next several years. And again, with the aspect of technology, I still think it's long-term leadership, and I would stick with them, and I would look for opportunity in the semis and semi-suppliers on the pullbacks. I'm seeing some great names like on an AEIS, Brooks Automation, BRKS, which we recently highlighted, coming back to the 200-day. We see 200-day moving averages taken out through, you know, a number of studies that we've done or provided throughout history. You know, it would be suggestive that anything above the 200-day moving average historically has a much better statistical score for us in terms of how it outperforms the market. I don't see any signs that those are weakening within technology to a degree that brings concern to me. So I think with what I gave you, I think that, again, that demonstrates just how broad this market really is.
I want to bring up something that is always lurking in the background, because we know that every recession, every bear market has always been preceded by a Fed rate raising cycle, which we're starting to see progress forward. Canada, the Central Bank of Canada has now raised interest rates. The ECB is indicating that they're going to cut back on QE. If there was anything that would cause you to pause or, let's say, give you a caution signal, what would that be?
Well, I think there's periods of time that we can go outside of what I think we've all been looking at in terms of history. And I think when we look back at history, most people would look back, you know, the last 40 years. Again, when you look at a post-World War II era, when rates were moving up, the market also moved up significantly post-World War II, along with rates. And, you know, I can't positively say that we're in that same time period, but it seems like most of the fear is gone from this market in terms of, hey, higher interest rates would suggest that the market is healthy. And where do we swing that pendulum too far to crack the market? I don't see it yet. And again, I won't see it until we start to see some significant negative numbers in terms of the economy come out that I think could concern the market. But I just don't know that I have a magic ball. Again, if we get above 3.2%, I'm probably going to swing the other way and suggest that, you know, the market is certainly showing signs of weakening. But again, you know, historically, when we look for a market toppiness, you know, one of the things that you typically would see is you'd see more money come into staples and utilities. We aren't bullish on either. We're still bearish. I just don't see them as relative strength leaders when you look at other time periods that they actually outperform historically. It's when rates are coming down, not up. And, you know, with a high fixed cost in both of those industries, I continue to see that they'll be pressured. And you're seeing it from a number of the food companies, such as General Mills, as an example, Kraft. There certainly doesn't bode positive to be in those sectors. And I would say that those sectors will do much better if we're getting into a bear market, and that would be rolling over the growth areas of the market. Again, I just don't see that.
Okay, so from your perspective and perch, we're seeing a little pullback here in some of the FANG and technology stocks, but the staples, utilities, the defensive type stocks are not doing well. Typically, you'd see that if we were heading towards danger. So from your perch right now, things are looking pretty good overall.
Things look good to me. I don't see any signs of concern. In fact, I think energy is probably, I'm seeing a lot of divergences within the energy stocks on RSIs, which in my opinion, they're probably seeing a bottom. But again, just because you see a bottom doesn't mean they lead. And I think you could have a trade up in them, but I would only view that as a trade at this point in time. I do think that it will take some time to form those bottoms and give concrete evidence to, you know, institutional investors and retail investors alike to move into that sector. But, you know, again, if I see those start to come together, even the material sector is showing some signs of strength, but it's not within the metals. In terms of gold and silver, of course, the precious metals, which are more in tune to what the dollar is going to do. And yet, despite the dollar having even weakened, we're not seeing, you know, trades up in the precious metals. So things like your chemical stocks actually look good. Like I mentioned, some of the fertilizer stocks are showing signs of potential bottoms. But there's a number of attractive areas within the chemicals, again, just on an industry basis. But again, you can't make a sector call there because you've got some strength in there and you have some weakness that's, you know, counterimposing it.
Well, listen, Dave, as we close, tell our listeners if they would like to follow your work or find out more about it, how they can do so. You do a lot of work on the markets, and specifically, you really get into sector analysis.
That's correct. VermilionCap.com is our website. Otherwise, you can also call us at 952-922-7500.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at FinancialSense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Lowell Smith. He's Chief Operating Officer of IRA Logix. And Lowell, before we get into some real specifics, let's talk about the difference usually between a person that is self-employed and somebody that works either for the government or a private corporation or a nonprofit organization. There's different kind of pension plans. We call them 401k. In the private sector, they're called 403b. If you work for a public school, if you're in government, we call them 457. Let's talk about the difference between those three and then talk about, as a businessman, what's the available options.
Sure. A 401k plan can be used for an individual, and we'll get into that when we're talking about smaller business plans. But those are different, typically for for-profit organizations. They could also be used in for not-for-profits that are also eligible for 403bs. But essentially in those situations, and in all those plans that you mentioned, the primary funding vehicle is the employee contribution. It's a pre-tax contribution, typically, but a 401k plan can also be an after-tax Roth contribution. There are limits on those corporation plans on how much you can contribute. So in 2017, for all those types of plans, an individual can put $18,000 away pre-tax. If they're under 50, if they're over 50, they can put another $6,000 away. So for a total of $24,000. In some instances, also, those organizations that sponsor them, whether they be a government organization or a not-for-profit organization of some sort, will have a matching contribution. And that matching contribution is really up to the discretion of the organization that puts that into place. 457s, though, do not have matching contributions. Typically, they're just a payroll deduction-only program.
Well, the gold market has been having some difficulty. I guess the good news, if you're a gold investor, is the price of gold is up this year, and some of the gold stocks. But with the dollar falling, why isn't gold rising even more? Joining us on the program from Maison Place Monde is John Ng. John, let's talk about the price of gold, because usually the dollar and gold are traveling in the opposite direction. We've had a decline in the value of the dollar, a rise in the euro, but gold seems to be having difficulty in this market. What accounts for that, in your opinion?
Well, Jim, I think it's a topsy-turvy world. The U.S. dollar should be firmer on expectation of higher rates, and in fact, it is weaker. Gold, in turn, should be higher in the face of a lower dollar, and it has recently hit, as you know, a four-month low, and on concerns that, in fact, the higher rates are around the corner. But we have to put it in perspective. I mean, the first bull move in gold, we saw that, was an 11-year period where gold hit almost 1947, I think it was, in 2011. Then we had now what I believe is the second move in gold, and that started last year when gold is up 9%. Year-to-date, gold is up almost 8%, yet everybody is moaning. And just a few weeks ago, gold had hit 1,300, or close to 1,300, flirted with a 1,200, and now is bouncing back. My belief is that the market is concerned about the future of what this quantitative easing. There's obviously a sea change happening, and as to the possible implications of what normalization means. But I keep on tracking is debt. And as we know, quantitative easing it was accomplished by just racking up more debt. Global debt, for example, in the whole world was something like $149 trillion. Now it's up 46% to $217 trillion. And my gosh, that's a whopping increase since, as we know, in order to get the economies going after the 07 crisis. But my sense is that central banks are finally, 8 years after this aging bull market, are looking to normalize. And in Canada, we just increased our rates by a quarter of 1%, and the market went higher. And we see some of the telltale signs, I think, of a market turning. We saw the FANG stocks, they retreated to their 50-day moving averages and then bounced back, but they seem to be churning. We have the cyber currencies, they seem to be churning. Some of the hot Hong Kong stocks have also been churning. And that tells me that we are at this point where there's a turn in the market. And that's why I think gold has had a pretty good underpinning at that $1,200 level. And my belief has been for some time, Jim, that the market is concerned about in the gold market is a possible rate hike and what it means for the gold market. And I must admit that since March of 2015, we've had now two rate increases and gold moved up from $1,150 to over $1,200. I can recall 2004, 2006 when rates went from 1% to 5.25%, and yet gold moved up. So it all depends on, to me, the level of interest rates, and we still have negative interest rates, as well as the climate. And I believe that we are getting a fundamental turn in this switching of the central banks from the ultra-loose policy to getting some sort of religion, although it will take time for them to tighten rates. And against that, and this is where my point on the dollar, why it's weak, is that you have to look at America's trading partners and what they have been doing with their economies and what they have been doing with their currencies. And I look at China, for example, which has had a firming currency. They have tightened their monetary policy, but by gosh, they continue to buy gold. And the Russians, at the same time, they are now 20 months in a row that they have been buying gold. My point is that other central banks, creditors of the United States, have been buying gold with the expectation that the dollar is not going higher. But in fact, I get a lot of stuff that the dollar, their expectation is the dollar is going to be much lower. So with that, therein lies a solid second prop to the gold price. So my expectation is that we are on the second move of the, and it's a beginning move of this bull market in the gold price.
So let's go from the price of gold, John, and talk about the industry itself. Because during this four-year downturn that we saw, not only in gold prices, but we also saw it begin in oil in 2014, a lot of the major oil companies have pulled back on trillions of dollars worth of investing, which means down the road, as demand increases, that's going to be a problem, because they're not replacing the oil that they're producing. Likewise, in the gold industry, when gold went through its downturn beginning in 2011, the price fell. A lot of companies shelved a lot of big projects that were in the process. They put them on the shelf. They're not spending a lot of money on exploration. So just like an oil company that produces oil needs to replace that oil, let's talk about the gold industry itself. Where are those reserves going to be replaced? Where are they finding them? I don't read about it.
That's a great question. It's my belief that we have had peak gold. That was last year. In other words, from here on in, less gold is going to come to the market. Part of the reason, of course, was because of the lower gold price, and that, as you mentioned, that a lot of projects were shelved. After all, there was something like $100 billion in write-downs in between 2014 and 2015. At the same time, an interesting note is that the grade has declined from 4.6 grams per ton to about 1 gram today. So, in other words, the low-hanging fruit has been plucked. And in fact, today there's something like only, I can count, seven undeveloped deposits of 50 with a grade, an average grade of 5 grams. Now, that's only 0.145 ounces per ton, but that means that there are just so little classic high grade or above average grade deposits in the world. And the mining industry, they pulled their horns. They took the write-downs. They moved the cost of production from something like $1,200 an ounce to under $1,000 an ounce. But they have not been replacing their reserves. Last year, something like 3 gold mines of the major producers replaced reserves. And that's a very small fraction. So what we have seen recently, and this is another reason why I'm bullish on the gold price, Jim, is that some of these majors, if they can't find it in the bush, what they're doing is they're buying it on Bay Street. And by that I mean is Newmont has taken a position in Continental Gold and will finance that project. Goldcorp has done a deal with Barrick, and they're trying to lessen, both Barrick and Goldcorp are lessening the risk, but they made an acquisition, that is Goldcorp, where they are going to do 50-50 on this Chilean deposit. And in turn, their hope is that if two companies can work on this together, Goldcorp putting up most of the money, that they can develop those reserves. The problem is that that's going to be 4 or 5 years down the road, and it could cost $4 or $5 billion. The Chinese got involved, and they Shandong did a deal with Barrick on a possible beginning stage on financing Pascua Lama, where Barrick had already spent something like $7 billion. That's on the Chilean-Argentine border, a very big deposit, but technically, and the capital cost is so huge. So what we are seeing is more and more of the majors looking to do joint ventures or, in fact, tuck-in acquisitions. Eldorado, which had to sell their Chinese deposits, Chinese gold mines, they ended up netting almost $1 billion. They are expanding in Greece, but they also had to lessen the geopolitical risks. And so they bought and they paid full value for Integra, which is a Canadian producer, a potential producer. And we find Endeavor, which is in picked up Avnil under $200 an ounce. So all this tells me that the gold companies, if they can't find it, they are going to buy it. And that also tells me that the market is valuing reserves in the ground very cheaply. I've done a calculation of these gold mines, of the reserves in the ground. And Jim, it's under $3 an ounce. So it's pretty cheap.
Let's talk about how the industry has changed, because in the last decade, with the run-up of gold from under $300 eventually to over $1,900, John, there was a lot of money that came into the industry. It fueled exploration, which was mainly done by the juniors. And as you say, a lot of those juniors got bought out at some very, very high prices. In fact, towards the end, companies were overpaying for ounces in the ground. Then we had the downturn. A lot of those companies are no longer around. It's very difficult getting money and financing. How does this turn around? Or if we do go into another up leg in this gold bull market you envision, what is it going to look like within the industry itself? In other words, where are the reserves going to come from? Because, John, I don't see too many juniors out there today that are left from, what was it, at one time, 2,000 of them. How many of those companies are around today? I've even heard of several companies, silver companies and producers that went to, you know, farming marijuana to make money. So where did the reserves come from? Who's doing the exploration?
I think that there's reserves, abundant reserves. The question is, at what price of gold will those reserves come out of the ground? And obviously, a gold price today under $2,000, not much gold is going to come out of the ground. So it's my belief that we have to get a much higher gold price in order to stimulate the exploration, in order to get the check writers to finance exploration. Today, for example, there are very few areas of the world where the majors want to go. Africa, so particularly South Africa, has presented problems. There's parts of Africa where only the brave go. Tanzania, Barrick is having problems with Acacia in Tanzania. And so the gold miners are looking at so-called geographically safe jurisdictions. But then you have some brave souls, and I've seen lightly explored areas, for example, like Ecuador, where Keith Barron has done a magnificent job. It's taken him a couple of years, but he has managed to put together, cobble together 200,000 hectares. So from a regional standpoint, I think that that's a good bet, and that some of these smart exploration companies are assembling land packages which, from a geological point of view, look interesting. And they're going to do the early stage development. And then if, as I expect, the gold price goes higher, then that money will come in. But today, it's a question of sort of get your seat at the theater. And we're still waiting for the movie to start.
So given the fact that central banks were going through a regime change and the fact that they're going to be now going from a loose monetary environment to maybe one that is much tighter, John, so what do you think is going to be the catalyst that is going to cause prices to spike? Will it be the realization that there's something happening to the stock market? Is it going to be a correction? Is it going to be a financial event? I mean, the rise in gold in the last decade was driven by economic growth in the emerging world that brought in tremendous amounts of demand from India, China, and elsewhere that were the drivers of gold. What will it be this time?
That's a very good point. My bet is that the world debt has gotten to a level that is unsustainable. And America, sadly, is the world's largest borrower. And we have this fall, for example, yet another period whereby the debt ceiling discussions, and we have a Washington circus where everybody's digging in their heels. That could be one so-called black swan. But more telling is that I believe that as the central banks tighten, it does increase the risk for accidents. And the accidents are always going to be financial accidents. And given the fact that the debt loads are so large, whether it's in America, whether it's in Italy, or even in the UK, which is they're undergoing problems whether in or out of the EU. And the creditors, on the other hand, such as China, Japan, what they're doing with their money is that they are very, very cautious. And I believe that the move by the central banks in purchasing gold, they have been net buyers of gold since 2010, is very telling that there is concern about the U.S. dollar and the fact that down the road, with all the geopolitical things that are happening, with, of course, the Washington circus, that, in fact, this is prime territory, ripe territory for accidents. And that's with the market value, with making daily highs, a risk is very, very high. We know the VIX is abysmal low. So my sense is that's the time when accidents happen. And that's why, to me, gold looks awfully powerful today. In fact, as you know, this week, it touched 1230 today.
All right. Well, listen, John, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do, I know you produce a newsletter. How could they find out more about it?
To reach us, just look at our website, maisonplasmon.com.
When the leaders of the world's largest hedge funds speak, people tend to listen, and some of them, such as Ray Dalio, who heads up Bridgewater, the world's most successful hedge fund manager, says, well, yeah, things may be rolling over, but you can keep on dancing for a while. Just scrunch a little closer to the exit door while you dance. That's coming up next in The Big Picture. We'll talk about the significance of Janet Yellen's testimony on Capitol Hill this week, as well as to how close we are to some kind of fundamental fundamental change in the markets. And then what are the disruptors? You know, technology is the driving force behind the U.S. economy, began with the tech revolution of the 80s and 90s. And we're seeing basically a new revolution in technology every 7 to 10 years. 2017 is the 10th anniversary of the iPhone. So how many changes did the iPhone bring about? And what are the next tech revolutions coming across the horizon? All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.